if indeed we find that there is wrongdoing, you know, I'll take steps to punish that and make it right. There's no question about that.
Governor Parnell responds to criticism over allegations of misconduct in the National Guard. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a leak at Prudhoe Bay spills natural gas over a large expanse of tundra.
A lot of the cleanup that's going to occur will probably be done with hand tools, and that's a lot of area to address with hand tools at these temperatures.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Governor Sean Parnell is defending his decision to wait 4 years to request a federal investigation into reports of a sexual assault problem in the Alaska National Guard. Anchorage Daily News columnist Shannon Moore wrote on Sunday that Parnell first learned about misconduct in the Guard in 2010 when he was approached by three Guard chaplains. Parnell says he took those charges seriously, but lacked the details to prompt an investigation until February. He says after the initial concerns were raised, he went to Major General Thomas Katkus to make sure the systems were in place to protect Guard members. Then in February, Parnell says he was able to talk with a Guard member who provided specifics.
That Guard member provided me with two instances where it appeared, if the allegations were substantiated, that the system would have failed our guard member. And at that point, I realized I needed to get an independent assessment of the entire reporting and investigation structure. And so I called in the National Guard Bureau. They have a complex investigation review team. So I did that within 24 hours as well of getting those specific details. And that team is on the ground now in Alaska doing their work to ensure that victims are safe.
I'm sure that you're aware that some people will think, why was it 4 years? What do you think maybe could have been done differently?
So at the time, I took action, and I took immediate action to make sure that every victim of a sexual assault had been referred to law enforcement. I made sure that anybody who had concerns about what was happening in the Guard had a safe reporting structure, but without specific detail about how the system was otherwise failing, that's all I could do, is what I believed. And I still believe that.
The Choose Respect campaign has been a big focus for you. Are you concerned that this may damage the momentum or the image that you're hoping to get across to Alaskans about coming forward when these things happen?
Well, absolutely. I don't think anybody, and I think the work that I have as governor as well as my life work, anybody who knows me would say that I care deeply about victims of sexual assault and domestic violence. And I'm more concerned than anything that victims may not come forward because I know from speaking with many across this state how difficult that already is. And I don't want to make that more difficult. That's why, you know, I've called in the National Guard Bureau to help, because I think it is beyond us at this point.
You're still standing behind General Katkus. Do you have confidence in him, or do you wish that he would have come to you sooner?
General Katkus has been very forthright. In other words, when I started asking questions about sexual assault cases, he came forward right away, showed me the cases that had been, you know, transferred to law enforcement, showed me how they have tracked cases, detailed how they investigate cases, and he's been very proactive about holding what the Guard calls sensing sessions, meaning going into Guard units and informing people about how to report acts of sexual harassment, acts of sexual violence. General Kakis has been very proactive in that regard, and that's what I know at this point.
McHugh Pierre was asking questions. He's the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Who asked him to have the chaplain sign confidentiality statements?
I don't know that, but I do have a copy of what he apparently asked to be signed. And what it actually says is it's a statement that was mailed out, or that was emailed, as he says it, to all DMVA employees. And it says that employees are not authorized to give statements on behalf of the department without first coordinating the request with one supervisor, which is standard operating policy in any department or in any business, that you don't speak for the business, you don't speak, you know, for the department without coordinating that with your supervisor. So that's as much as I know, and I'm happy to give you a copy of that.
He also spoke with people on base about wanting to know how information was getting out. It almost feels a bit like a witch hunt that he was looking for people, and this letter, asking the chaplains to sign this letter, apparently he wouldn't give them a copy of it when they left. Does that concern you that oftentimes it takes people acting outside of the normal channels in order to get this information forward? And at the end of the day, that's the main mission, is it not?
Well, that's true. And I mean, that's why I ask these questions. Again, there's nothing that stops an employee as long as they're not speaking on behalf of the department. In other words, they're speaking as a person, as an Alaskan who's concerned. That's not what this statement addresses, though.
But the chaplains weren't saying that they were speaking for the department. They were raising concerns about people who were alleging sexual assault.
And I don't condone, you know, the activity that you just described. I do, on the other hand, understand when supervisors are asking their employees not to represent the department on certain things. In this case, I don't have all the facts, but I can tell you I don't condone, you know, trying to stop what you're describing.
You're saying you wouldn't condone McHugh Pierre asking them to be quiet?
No. But again, I don't have evidence that that's what he did. What I have evidence is that he asked them not to speak on behalf of the department without coordinating that with a supervisor.
Governor, how frustrated are you, and what have you taken away from this process? Do you think that there's things that need to be done differently?
Well, I am frustrated when Alaskans in the Guard don't feel like they are protected. That's entirely frustrating. And it's frustrating to me when I don't have enough information to take action beyond what I did. So if indeed we find that there is wrongdoing, you know, I'll take steps to punish that and make it right. There's no question about that.
Governor Sean Parnell defending his decision to wait until 2 months ago to ask for a federal investigation of sexual misconduct in the Alaska National Guard. To read a transcript of a longer version of this interview, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is the latest outside group to launch campaign ads in Alaska's U.S. Senate race. The National Business Lobby has a 30-second video spot running this week that hits Begich and supports one of his Republican challengers, former Attorney General Dan Sullivan.
Mark Begich sided with Washington again. Dan Sullivan puts Alaska first. He has a track record.
Anchorage Chamber of Commerce President Andrew Halcrow immediately issued a statement to say the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is a separate organization.
We just wanted our members to know that these ads that are identified as being produced by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce have no affiliation to the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce.
Likewise, the Alaska Chamber of Commerce says it doesn't endorse federal candidates. The Alaska Chamber, though, is a member of the U.S. Chamber. President Rachel Petro says the U.S. group notified her of the ad, but says the Alaska Chamber had no input.
We just have no opinion on this topic, and we have nothing to do with those ads.
The U.S. Chamber is also running ads for candidates in four other states starting this week. Sullivan's older brother, Frank Sullivan, who runs the Ohio company that makes Rust-Oleum and other coatings, sits on the board of directors of the U.S. Chamber. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a gold mining operation gets a scare near Nome as the Bering Sea ice breaks apart.
We didn't lose any equipment. There's no trash left behind, or didn't sink any trucks or anything like that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
A flow line to a well operated by BP at Prudhoe Bay leaked on Monday. As KYC's Emily Schwing reports, before the spill was under control, high winds resulted in a spray of natural gas, crude oil, and water that covers an area of tundra larger than 20 football fields.
According to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, operators with BP were working at a well when a flow line began leaking. Ashley Adamczak is an environmental program specialist with DEC. She says 30-mile-an-hour winds on the North Slope sprayed leaking natural gas, water, and crude oil across an estimated 27 acres of snow-covered tundra.
What has not been delineated at this time is the part that has been moderately or lightly misted.
The leak was isolated roughly 2 hours after it began. With temperatures still below freezing on the North Slope, Adamczak says the entire well pad has been shut down in order to protect other wells from freezing or leaking.
There's millions of miles of pipe and thousands of wells up on the North Slope, and then spills do happen. We don't get a lot of these spills coming through, but I can't say that this is the first time that a spill like this has occurred.
It's still unclear how many gallons of gas, oil, and water have spread across the tundra. Adamczak says cleanup will be challenging.
Due to the fact that a lot of it was spilled to the tundra, then they have to go out there with less aggressive means so that they don't actually make the response activities cause more of an impact than the spill did. So a lot of the cleanup that's going to occur will probably be done with hand tools. And that's a lot of area to address with hand tools at these temperatures.
DEC is working with the North Slope Borough, BP Exploration, and the Environmental Protection Agency to respond to the incident. There's no estimate on how long it will take, but Adamczak says the agencies hope to complete cleanup before migrating geese start to arrive on the North Slope. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The early breakup of sea ice has left winter gold dredging operations scrambling to haul equipment back to shore. Jesse Strickling is part of the Lazy Gator mining operation that got cut off from shore when the chunk of ice they were staged on detached on Sunday.
This is pretty crazy. We've been running our little tails off there at the end of the season trying to get the last bit of gold that we could. And we went out there, got everything packed up, and got ready to leave and turned around to go home. And there's an open lead there. We're all kind of freaked out for a couple minutes.
At stake were trucks, all-terrain vehicles, and mining equipment worth about $100,000 altogether, not counting tens of thousands of dollars in gold. That evening, Alaska State Troopers followed up on reports of a stranded mining party. Matt Johnson is chief of Nome's search and rescue operations.
We were dispatched approximately 5:30 for some people that were stuck on an ice floe, and we traveled up to West Beach about 8 miles with a Zodiac raft and brought two individuals back to the shoreline.
Strickling and others told rescuers they had things under control, though two crew members were exhausted from hours of work and accepted a ride back into town. Johnson says rescue operations connected to mining have increased in the last few years.
We've definitely had to respond more this year than we have in the past for gold miners. In the past, it has been responding usually for people that have been out hunting and couldn't get back into shore. Now we're having to respond out for people that are leaving the shore and going out to sea.
Spencer McCleskey is in his second season dredging on the ice. He says last year there were just 5 crews, but this year that number jumped to 11 or 12, partly from economic pressure for operations to stay profitable year-round, and partly from Discovery Channel's Bering Sea Gold franchise.
It's really crazy that the ice is leaving this early and that we're even having this issue. Usually the ice doesn't leave for a couple weeks. Everybody expected to have a couple more weeks, but it looks like the season's over.
There is very little regulation of the expanding cottage industry on the ice. Officials at Nome's port and city office say they are not responsible for offshore property or safety issues. Department of Public Safety spokesperson Megan Peters says search and rescue mobilizes to save lives, but not property. According to the Department of Natural Resources, in the winter, there is no state or federal agency with safety or environmental oversight present in Nome to monitor gold dredging on the ice. If operators do spill fuel or lose equipment in the water, they're responsible for reporting it to DEC and DNR, but neither agency has boots on the ground until the summer. The Lazy Gator crew made another attempt last night to get back to the edge of the last of their equipment. They cut out a large section of ice beneath the trucks and towed them toward the solid ice shelf attached to shore, and they got lucky.
We had to just kind of wait it out. The tide came in and pushed it up onto the beach. Started pressure ridging pretty good and drove the trucks off. Really lucky though, we didn't lose any equipment. There was no trash left behind or didn't sink any trucks or anything like that.
With the ice float buckling and breaking beneath them, the drivers gunned the trucks and got them to shore inside a 30-second window.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The reliability of the food supply is not something most communities devote much thought to. Agriculture, transportation, and grocery stores all work pretty well, even in relatively isolated parts of Alaska like Sitka. And depending on where you live, there can be abundant wild foods. But a recent report called the Sitka Community Food Assessment reveals that the food system is vulnerable, especially to the unpredictable costs of fuel. Lisa Sadler Hart coordinated the assessment. She stopped by KCAW recently to talk with Robert Woolsey about what Sitka and communities like it can do to become more food secure.
The idea for taking a look at Sitka's food supply took root, so to speak, at the Community Health Summit in the fall of 2012. At that time, food security was still kind of abstract. That changed on the night of January 4th when Sitka was rocked by a magnitude 7.2 earthquake. We had 45 minutes to get to high ground, leaving behind all of our grocery stores and most of our food at sea level.
And it became very real on a community level when we actually had that event.
But even before the threat of a tsunami focused Sitka's attention on food security, people were feeling the pinch of the high cost of groceries, aggravated by the economic recession beginning in 2008.
Many of us working in the food arena for a long time also realized that because we were seeing rising food prices, we had a lot of concerns about what that meant for household food security. So we have kind of two layers. We have overall community food security. So can we provide for ourselves and feed ourselves as a community? And then secondary, can households do the same?
With the goal of finding answers to those questions, Sadler Hart and her work group adopted the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Security Assessment Toolkit and went to work. They surveyed over 400 Sitkins, conducted focus groups, met with community leaders, and explored alternative sources of information like the Cooperative Extension Agency at the University of Alaska. A year after the earthquake, food security was no longer abstract. Sadler Hart has hard data. Her report brings home several key points.
I think a big one that's a real plus for our community is how generous our community is. So, and how reliant we are on traditional and customary foods, what often people call subsistence foods. We eat a lot of deer in this town. We eat a lot of fish and seafood, and then we also forage and harvest. And a lot of that gets shared from one household to another. Sometimes related households, sometimes not related, just the fact that they're friends. That really jumped off the page at me.
Sadler Hart says that the use of food stamps has increased by 40% in Sitka since the mid-2000s. Grocery prices began a sharp climb in 2008, harnessed to the cost of fuel. The assessment shows clearly who is bearing the brunt of this perfect storm of economic insecurity.
When we talk to elders in a focus group, you know, some of them, they go without. They don't eat. And others get really creative, like some single-parent families. They'll show up at church potlucks to try to get a meal for them and their kids. You know, so some really interesting strategies, that kind of stuff also popped out at me.
The food assessment is a huge source of information about economic conditions in Sitka. It's also a tool for making policy. Sadler Hart says a first step is to begin to make more public land available for gardening.
We know that for many households in our community, probably 95% of their food is coming, is imported from somewhere else, right? Because most of the food that we eat in the state is imported, 95% of it from somewhere else. And our guesstimates that as recent as the 1950s, that was only 50%. So I think we can get to 50% now over the next couple of decades. I think it's going to take this is a long-term venture. It took us a long time with cheap, you know, oil and transportation to kind of get us into this really, I don't know if you would call it lazy or what you would call it, but we've just become accustomed to not having to work at accessing our food very hard.
50%, that's a lot of potatoes.
It's a lot of potatoes, it's a lot of seaweed, it's a lod of deer, it's a lod of ling cod, it's a lod of gardens. And what I mean, you can grow a lot of food. I grow a lot of food out of my garden, a lot of which I don't eat, that I donate then to the farmer's market. So, you know, if I can do it, I think other people can do it.
Sadler Hart also believes it's important to maintain eligibility for food stamps as much for the economic impact of the program as for its contribution to nutrition. She says it pumps about $200,000 annually into the economy. She also says Sitka's rural subsistence designation and the access it allows to customary and traditional foods is more than a lifestyle choice. Hunting, fishing, and gathering are a major economic component of food security.
Deer meat alone was like almost $1.5 million in a year. So if we were going to try to replace deer meat out with some other equivalent protein source, most households couldn't afford to buy it, quite frankly.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
About 850,000 cruise ship passengers are expected to visit Ketchikan this season. And the first megaship of the year, a Holland Cruise Line vessel, docked in the city yesterday. The cruise started in Japan, and Ketchikan was the final stop before the cruise ends in Vancouver. KRBD's Emily Files went downtown to talk to tourists and business owners who were just opening shop.
Silver Line North.
Okay.
It's going north. It'll go through the tunnel.
How far from here?
It'll go all the way.
An employee at the Ketchikan Visitor Center is explaining the city's bus system to a tourist couple wearing rain gear. The center is filled with passengers from the Volendam who are taking shelter from rain and asking questions about Ketchikan. Carrie is the visitor services coordinator here.
I think we're off to an okay start. We'll see how it goes. I think it's good. Yeah, it's always exciting. The first ship is always kind of exciting, and everybody, there's a lot of energy in the air.
I caught a couple tourists as they were heading out the door.
Bill and Terry Heaver.
And where are you all from?
Williamsburg, Virginia.
What are you all planning to do in Ketchikan?
What we intend to do, we're just going to sightsee. Just take a look around, see what you have to offer.
Anything in particular you want to see?
Eagles. I'm dying to see. I love birds, and I want to see the eagles.
Bill and Terry are celebrating their 50th anniversary with this cruise. They say they had no idea Alaska was so vast, and they hope to come back again. Outside of the visitor center, it's cold and rainy, but that's driving people into the shops lining downtown Ketchikan. A lot of those shops have been closed all winter and are just opening for the season today.
My name is Kanoe Thomas, and I work for Alaska Bear Company. We opened today, and we just got the store ready, and we are a local store, so we've been trying to get the store ready before the ships come in. It's actually really exciting because in the wintertime here, it's kind of like a ghost town downtown, and so when the cruise ships come in, it's kind of like the downtown's really alive, so I'm really excited to meet new people this year.
I'm Ted Zavakis from the Yukon East Popcorn Emporium. We opened today.
So what's it like to interact with the tourists?
I love it. I mean, meeting new people every day. It's just, it's such a neat, you know, and because most people, you know, we get a lot of foreign, non-U.S. folks, and so they're just so interesting to talk to hear their dialects and their accents.
There are about a dozen traffic guards scattered downtown wearing orange and yellow vests. They're holding stop signs at some of the busy crosswalks.
My name is Dusinger Jabel. It's important for us to be out here helping because, When the cruise ship season starts, we have the tourists, and then we have to make sure they are safe from getting hit by a car, something like that. That's why we control the traffic so that they are safe.
When they're not crossing the street, the tourists are in the shops.
I'm Corinne. I'm from Singapore. A second time in Ketchikan, yeah.
So how would you describe Alaska to your friends back in, you said Singapore?
Fantastic place, you know, magnificent glacier scenery. And friendly people. I'll tell them to come.
Not all of the tourists have positive things to say about Alaska. Before Ketchikan, the Volendam stopped in Juneau. This is Kel from Calgary, Canada.
I just want to say Juneau, being your capital of the state of Alaska, needs to improve itself a lot. It left a really bad impression on a lot of the people on the ship because it's so run down. A lot of intoxicated people walking around the streets.
The only complaint tourists seem to have about Ketchikan was the rain. The next cruise ship docks in town May 4th. I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Emily Files in Ketchikan. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal Housing Lender, member FDIC. Salmon Love presents the Salmon Haiku Contest through April 30th. Do you have a poetic, funny, and creative Alaska salmon haiku in you like this one? Fresh fry awakens, moving through ripples. Silently, an epic journey blossoms. That's Salmon Love haiku style. Information on how to enter the Salmon Haiku Contest at salmonlove.com. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with Dennis Hayes, CEO of the world's most energy-efficient commercial building, on Thursday, May 1st, during the 6th Annual Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena'ina Center. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.